Well, today in our series of the Psalms and their backstories, we're coming to the 126th Psalm, which again is a beautiful Psalm. When the people come back from captivity, they're so happy. And so the feel of this Psalm is very uplifting, very exciting. And so Psalm 126. In the old Disney movie about Peter Pan, you might know that there was this song they sang about dreams and making dreams and dreams come true. That's all part of the whole, you know, Disney mystique. And in the Peter Pan song, You Can Fly, it says, when there's a smile in your heart, there's no better time to start. Think of all the joy you'll find when you leave the world behind and bid your cares goodbye. You can fly and up you go beyond the blue. There's Neverland waiting for you where all your happy dreams come true. Every dream you dream comes true and bid your cares goodbye. You can fly. And you think, yeah, you know, that's kid stuff. Of course, Peter Pan is kid stuff. But, I mean, doesn't your heart tell you that there is a reason that children latch onto those things? You know, what's the reason? And we suggest the reason is because God has put eternity in all of our hearts, and we are aware that there is supposed to be a better world than this one. There's supposed to be a way that you can leave all your cares behind. And so it comes up often in Disney and in popular culture. Disney said, all our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. In 1940, when Pinocchio came out, when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. In 1950, when Cinderella came out, a dream is a wish your heart makes. In 1959, when Sleeping Beauty came out, I know you, I walk with you once upon a dream. And the Epcot Center motto is, if you can dream it, you can do it. Today, we're looking at a Bible verse about what you dream about. Like, too good to be true. It's like a dream. So here we are in the 126th Psalm, and the opening line is, when the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, that is when he returned the captives to Jerusalem, to Zion, then we were like those who dream. This is amazing. I have to pinch myself. Is this real? We were like those who dream. And so that's the feeling of the Psalm we have before us today. Now, a couple things to notice on the side. This is one of 15 what we call songs of degree, and you look at the titles above the Psalms, you see that there are 15 of these Psalms that say this is a song of degrees. And we think it's degrees, the word can mean degree, like you're going up by degrees, or ascents, you're making an ascent, or a song of steps. And all the Psalms from 120, Psalm 120 to 134, are in this group of songs of ascent. Now, we think, that as pilgrims were making their journey to Jerusalem from all over the Holy Land during all their feast days, while they passed in caravans, somebody would strike up these psalms and they would all sing them together to help pass the time. So imagine people, you know, walking in a parade, coming from all directions. And by the way, remember, because Jerusalem is on a mountain, everybody goes up to Jerusalem, no matter if you start north, south, east, west, you have to go up to go to the top of the hill for Jerusalem. So they start to sing these songs of degrees, and we think that was probably the case. If that was not the case, at least we're very sure about this. You should know that every Feast of Tabernacles, the Levites would stand on 15 steps, and they would sing these 15 psalms, songs of degrees, on the 15 steps. And if you look at the yellow arrow here on our graphic, you can just sort of see that there are 15 steps there. I mean, you can maybe see a little circular stairwell at the point of that arrow. So imagine the Levite choir and musicians, right, because they have instruments as well as singers, and they're all on these 15 steps. It makes a natural riser, you know, like a platform for them to stand on, and they're singing these 15 psalms. So the one we're looking at today, they would come to a certain place, and they say, you know, when the Lord returned the captives to Zion, we were like people who dreamed, and so they would sing the song and play the music for that psalm. And so this was one of the things that took place every single Feast of Tabernacles, which is a 7-day week-long feast. So every single Feast of Tabernacles, every single day during the water ceremony, because the priest would take a parade of people to the Pool of Siloam and bring a golden pitcher of water up those stairs past the Levites who are singing and through the bronze doors 30 feet high. And they weighed tons each. It took 20 people to swing the doors open. So the Levites singing their song. Here comes the priest with the golden pitcher. Walks up the stairs while they're singing. They swing the doors open. And they pour out the water from the pool of Siloam. They pour it onto the altar where there's the big fire and everything. That little bit of water's not going to put out the fire. And they pour it on there with this prayer. Lord, please give us water. Give us rain again for our harvest. Feast of Tabernacles, and that was taking place every day for 7 days, every single year at the Feast of Tabernacles. And this psalm was the psalm they sang. When the Lord returned us from captivity, we were like people who dream. It was so wonderful. And every single year, every single day during Feast of Tabernacles. So here's the psalm. When the Lord turned again, returned the captive ones, the captivity of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue was singing. Then they said among the Gentiles, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, of which we are glad. Turn again our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. Those who sow in tears shall harvest in joy. He who goes forth and weeps, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. And so that is the 126th Psalm. I want to show you three things about this psalm that I like very much. The first one is that God really will make all your dreams come true if you just follow Him. And so let's talk about that. Verse 1. When the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like those who dream. And then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongues with singing. So you can hear the festivity, right? The celebration is such a great thing. Imagine they've been in captivity in Babylon for 70 years. And Babylon lost the war to Persia, so now the Babylonian king is replaced by the Persian king. The Persian king's name is Cyrus. And in 536, Cyrus said, okay, anybody who wants to go back to the Holy Land can go back. Why did he do that? That is such a crazy thing. And by the way, Isaiah foretold that this was going to happen. Isaiah lived in 700s. This is taking place in actually 538. So Isaiah's in the 700s. He says, yeah, in 538, he doesn't say the time. He says, there's going to be this guy named Cyrus who's like a shepherd to God's people, and he's going to give them kindness and tell them to return back to their land. Well, that's so great that Isaiah knew that because the people weren't in captivity yet. They were in their land, and Isaiah knew that they would be, you know, exiled from their land and then brought back to their land, and that a guy named Cyrus was going to do it. I mean, this is uncanny. People look at that and they say, well, there's no way that a person named Isaiah could have written that because there's no such thing as supernatural prophecy. And whoever wrote that about Cyrus telling the people to come back, whoever wrote that could not have been the real Isaiah. That had to be somebody, you know, way in the future looking back and saying, this is what's going to happen. At any rate, so picture this. All the other kings from Babylon and Persia thought it was great to have captives. And then you get to Cyrus, he says, you know what, I think I'm going to let those captives go. And the people are like, why? We didn't pay him. We didn't force him. Why is he going to let us go? And you imagine them walking around saying, you know, is this possible? I mean, we can go home whenever we want to. Like right now, if we want to, we can go home right now. And the answer was, yeah. And you mean I can take my whole family, not just me. I'll bring my whole family. Yep, take whoever you want. And I can bring my stuff. Yeah, bring whatever you want. Go back home. Like, you're kidding. Why? You know, what's the trick? And there was no trick. And they said, well, when we were told we could go back home with our families and our possessions, we were like people who dreamed. Like, this isn't even possible, is it? And that's the feel. In 1989, Don Piper was a Baptist minister, and he was in a terrible car accident with a semi-tractor. And it hit Don so hard that his left arm was severed. It was in the back seat of the car. His left leg was basically severed, hanging just by a few, you know, shreds of tissue. And he was bleeding out of his ears and his eyes. Four different paramedic teams came along and declared him dead. They pronounced him dead. He had no pulse, and they pronounced him dead. And then 90 minutes later, his pulse started again, and he started singing a little bit, not much, but he was singing because somebody was singing praise songs next to him. And they said, this guy's alive. He's not dead. And evidently, he was dead. And he says, when he was hit by this truck. He said, I was instantly transported to heaven's gate. I did not see a single person that I did not know. They were relatives, friends, people I had seen and known all my life who had gone to glory. They were smiling, embracing me, welcoming me. They were in the process of taking me through the gate of heaven. My mindset now is to want to be there again. Not a single day has passed in which I haven't felt an intense longing to be back in that celestial city where I heard the most perfect music and had total inner peace. Heaven ceased to be a possibility for me and became a reality. Heaven is now my reality, not the life I live now on earth. It's not that I mind being here. I'm actually very excited to be here, but I can't wait to go back there. Someday you are going to go to heaven. Hopefully you don't have to get hit by a tractor trailer to do it. Someday you're going to go to heaven, and your first thought is going to be, you have to pinch me. Like, we were like people who dreamed, is this real? Is this possible? This is so great. And that's what your salvation is like. But it's not just salvation. The Lord gives us these dreams come true in little ways as well. So I love the story of Jeff and Cheryl Shrugs. Cheryl, they had a fairy tale romance, had tons of money. They had a house with a view of the ocean in Southern California. I mean, what could be better than that, right? And so they are just living the perfect life. But Cheryl's not happy. She's irritable. She has no joy in life. And eventually, just out of, you know, boredom and foolishness, she starts up an affair. And Jeff is really offended by this. He thought it was so cruel. And after she starts up this affair, then she wants to divorce. And Jeff is pretty upset. You know, like, this is just vicious. Why are you doing this? And so the divorce happened only a very short time later. Cheryl broke it off with this man that she left Jeff for. And then she started going to church and she became a Christian. Jeff had already been a Christian since childhood, but he had strayed from the faith and he wasn't very much interested in the gospel things anymore while he and Cheryl were together. But since then, now he's rethinking some things and he goes back to his childhood faith that really meant a lot to him when he was younger. So they are now both Christians. And Cheryl begins to dream about the prospect of putting their family back together. Maybe they could be reconciled. But Jeff isn't having it. No way. He says, you broke my heart in the most cruel and vicious way. You wouldn't talk to me when I was trying to dissuade you from this course. You wouldn't talk to me, and I will never trust you again. But Cheryl wants to. She wants to reconcile the family. So eventually, after years go by, she says, would you at least let me come over and read you my letter of apology? He says, okay. So she reads the letter of apology. They're both in tears. And Jeff said, that's fine, but I want you to know, I will never, ever trust you again. I'm sorry, I just won't. And Jeff says, I was so angry at Cheryl that I couldn't even look at her. I would go over to the house to pick up the girls, they had two girls, and just pray that I wouldn't have to look her in the eye or say anything. So, I mean, this relationship is as spoiled as it can get. It's bad. And then, after the apology letter, Cheryl, every week when they exchange the children, you know, she says, would you like to stay for dinner? And every week, Jeff says, no, I'm not going to stay for dinner. And then one day she asked, and he said, oh, okay, I think I will stay for dinner. They started doing that every single week. Time came when they all realized, the daughters, Cheryl, Jeff, they all realized that that was their favorite day of the week because they were going to get together and have dinner. And they started looking forward to it. Well, then, the crisis, if you will, came when one of the daughters had part of the outfit she wanted to wear at mom's house and part of the outfit at dad's house, and she has a friend over, and the daughter's all upset, and the friend looks at Jeff with her hands on her hips and scolds him and says, this is ridiculous. You two get along better than my parents, and they're still together. Why don't you just get remarried? So they did. Cheryl says, we sat the girls down and Jeff said, Mom and I are getting remarried. And Jeff says, Brittany just buckled at the knees and started crying. And Lauren's going, is it for real? Is it for real? Because during that whole time, they've been praying that God would work a miracle and just put our family back together. And it was for real. It's like, pinch me. Is this a dream? We were like people who dream. This is really going to happen. So after 7 years being divorced, They were reconciled. Cheryl says, we've been remarried now for 9 years. And Jeff says, it's definitely a miracle. I wake up every morning with Cheryl beside me, and it's like I have to pinch myself. I can't believe that our family is back together. Now we realize that all the worldly things, the possessions, the house with an ocean view, that stuff is just junk. We learn that marriage takes three. Me, Cheryl, and Jesus. And we learn that marriage only works when Jesus is first. See, we were like people who dream the Lord will give you dreams to come true if you just follow Him, and so we should. The second great thing about this psalm is that God's already dreams come true, things He's already done for us in the past, posture us for more dreams that come true in the future. And so it's not over yet, and the psalmist knows this. So in verse 3, our psalm says, the Lord has done great things for us, of which we are glad. But then verse 4 says, turn again our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. All right, so picture this. The people have been allowed to go back, and they do go back. The first wave of people that went right away when Cyrus said, if you want to go home, go home. The first wave of people would be about 50,000 of them. But 50,000 doesn't make a nation. You know, Teresa and I had our first church ministry in an area of about 50,000. It was a city and two surrounding cities, not even big cities. 50,000 isn't a nation. In our case, it was the area around Prescott, Arizona. That's not a nation. That's a couple of cities. And so you can go back. And they, can you believe it? We can go back. And 50,000 do go back right away. But then when Ezra comes along, about 100 years later, he brings a few more, not that many, about 5,000. When Nehemiah comes along, another 100 years later, he brings some, not that many, thousands, but not that many thousands. But 50,000, that doesn't cut it. So the psalmist says, the Lord has done great things. The Lord has returned the captivity. Here we are. But Lord, what we need now, we need a lot more people. We need people like in the desert. If you've ever lived in the desert, they have these washes. Imagine a dried up creek of gravel or sand, and there's no water in it. But every once in a while, usually in August or September, it rains in a deluge. And all of those dry creek beds, they start to flow. And they flow so fast, and they rise so high that sometimes they knock out the bridges in the Phoenix area. So the psalmist is saying, Lord, thank you so much for returning the captives. But we don't need just 50,000 people. We need a deluge. We need this dry creek bed to just be flooded and moving fast. Would you please do that for us? So the dream comes true. Cyrus says, yeah, you can go back. And then the follow-up, but Lord, would you even do more than that? And the Lord did, of course, bring back the, you know, the reality of a nation, not just 50,000 people. And that's great. The Lord has already done great things, but then He adds on to that. So like in the story of Glenda Revel, she was saved from sin, horrible child abuse. Her parents were mean to her in every way, without being graphic, in every way they were mean to her. She was saved from sin and child abuse and suicide and hell. But then she was also granted a real start in life, a godly husband, and a meaningful ministry, a really great life. So the Lord had been so good, you know, turned the captivity back. But then He gave her much more than that, too. Martha Hawkins, you remember we talked about her a few weeks back. She was saved from sin and mental illness and suicide and hell. But then she was also granted a restaurant business, which was her lifelong dream. She always wanted to have a restaurant and an enormous circle of friends. People all love her and a meaningful witness. She's like a testimony to the world of how God can save you from the worst of conditions and then give you such a happy life. So, yeah, you brought back the captivity. I'm saved. But not only that, I have a restaurant. Annie Lobert was saved from sin, prostitution, addiction, suicide, and hell. But then she was also granted an entirely new kind of life with a real family this time and with a ministry to others in hardship and crisis. And so, Lord, we're like people who've awakened from a dream. You've given us salvation. It's so great. But would you also make more dreams come true? And He tends to do it. And that brings us to our last great point from this short psalm. And that is that in all of this, we are laborers together with God in these dreams that come true. And so we find that the psalmist is going to take some responsibility here and work with the Lord. And that's good. Because in verse 5, those who sow in tears, sowing is planting, but tends to mean that you broadcast your seed like grass seed. All the great civilizations in ancient time were advanced suddenly when they developed the cereal grains, the grass grains. When you can throw seed like this in a plowed furrow, but you throw seed like this, and it grows like grass and becomes wheat and barley and, in Asia, rice. Once you get that, now you have a for real crop that you can count on every year, and you're just not hunting and foraging. You have a real crop. Well, these people come back from the Holy Land and to the Holy Land, and what do they find? Land that has been abandoned, like no care, completely neglected for 70 years. And now they have to build their family farms. Like, okay, this will be my farm. It's like, look at that land. That's a terrible piece of land. What are you supposed to do with that? So the psalmist says, those who sow in tears, we're going to plant our wheat and our other cereal grains. Those who sow in tears shall harvest in joy. He who goes forth and weeps, bearing precious seed. Precious because we don't have much of it. Picture this. You come back to the land, you're pretty poor. Now, that seed right there, you can grind that up, turn that into flour, and then bake the flour into bread. But you're not going to, and you don't even have much seed. You don't have much grain. So you're going to take that out of the mouths of your children, and you're going to throw it down on the ground. Like, you have got to be kidding me. We're going to take what little we have, and we're going to throw that on the ground. And if the Lord makes it grow, then we're going to have a crop. And if He doesn't make it grow, now we have no food for our children. So you're going to sow in tears. Like, okay, I'm taking this food essentially out of my kid's mouth, and I'm going to throw it down. And it's breaking my heart to do it. You sow in tears. And the seed is precious. Precious because you don't have much of it. Like, oh no. You know, here we go. So, those who sow in tears shall harvest in joy. He who goes forth and weeps, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. And of course, this was the reality in an agricultural community. They were literally going to take the seed and throw it on the ground and pray for a harvest that will bring them rejoicing. So literally, but also it's figurative for what they're doing with their whole lives. We're the first ones back in the Holy Land. We have to turn this wasteland into a nation. How are we going to do this? We don't have the resources to do it. In 1 Corinthians 3:9, we are laborers together with God. You are God's building. According to the grace of God given unto me as wise master builder, I have laid the foundation. Another builds on it. But let every man take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can any man lay than that which is laid, which is Christ. So we are laborers together with God. Isn't that something? When those first captives came back to Jerusalem, they were with God. God and they were partners. We are laborers together with God. And that's the only way life is ever going to work for any of us. We have to be laborers with God. Now, of course, God is more than an equal partner in this, right? It, so much just depends on Him. But there is a part for us to play. For those people in that day, they're going to have to work really hard. They're going to be planting in tears. Like, this was a really hard job. So they have their part, and God has His part. And Paul says, that's ever the way, even for you and me. The laws of harvest here are really important to remember. You're going to sow your precious seed. You don't have a lot of it. You're going to take what you have, and you're going to sow it. You're going to broadcast it. And here's how the law of harvest works. In the first place, you reap whatever you sow. If you sow wheat, you get wheat back as your harvest. If you sow barley, you get barley as your harvest. And that's really important. By the way, that's important in everything you do in life. If you sow good things in life, you're going to harvest good things. And if you sow sin, then you're going to harvest the wages of sin. So always remember that whatever you plant, you harvest. The second law of harvest is you always reap more than you sow. So we put, you know, those seeds out there. But then we get a sheaf of wheat. It looks sort of like corn on the cob, right? A little sheaf of wheat has all these kernels on it. And we sowed, you know, one seed took root and gave us that sheaf with many kernels. And so whatever you sow, you reap. And you always reap a lot more than you sow. And that's good if you're sowing good. I'm going to plant goodness. Well, if you plant goodness, you're going to harvest a lot more goodness from God. You're not going to outgive God, right? On the other hand, if you sow sin, you're going to have a harvest for sin. And you're not going to like that because you always get back a lot more than you planted. You plant evil, you plant bad, you get bad, and a lot more than you planted. And the last law of harvest is there's actually a lot of time between sowing and reaping. It's kind of tricky. Like if you went out sowing in tears and you threw the seed down and poof, you suddenly had a wheat crop, I'm like, well, you know, that's okay. But that's not how it works. There's a long time between planting and harvesting, and that's what fakes us out. Because we think, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm so glad I didn't take my precious seed and throw it on the ground because now I have seed that I'll turn into wheat and flour for my bread for my children. So I'm so glad I didn't plant. Like, no, that's the tricky part. You have to wait a long time between planting and harvesting to see how wise the Lord is. And so that's the law of harvest. Alice Fisher. This works for evangelism. Alice Fisher had an unsaved neighbor who cut her beloved tree down. She loved that tree, and the crazy guy came over and cut it down because he didn't like it. Well, she was pretty upset about that for about a month and a half. And then she said, this isn't right. I'm a Christian. He's not a Christian. I have to be nice to him. So she took a cake over to him and said, hi, neighbor, I made this. I thought maybe you'd like to have this. He closed the door in her face and didn't even take the cake. A little while later, she thought, I'm going to try homemade pudding. Took some homemade pudding over to him. Hi, neighbor, I made you some homemade pudding. I wonder if you like this. Like, kind of grouchy, but he took it. I guess he likes pudding better than cake. And then, a little while after that, she has a flower garden. She gets some flowers. I'm going to take that over to the neighbor. So she comes, I made these flowers for you. And he took them, and he thanked her. A week later, he's dead. Died of a heart attack. The wife has no friends because she was married to a curmudgeon. She has no friends. And the thought occurs to her, I'm in the depths of despair. That's a great word, isn't it? Curmudgeon means grouch. I'm in the depths of despair. Do I even have any friends in the world? I have one friend. She brought us cake and pudding and flowers. And she went over to her neighbor and she really relied on her neighbor. Next thing you know, the grieving widow is telling her kids and other family members, I have the best neighbor in the world. Next thing you know, Alice is a hero to everybody, and she's drawing them all to Jesus. I'm going to sow in tears. I hate this. It's no fun having the door in your face. I'm going to sow in tears, but then I'm going to come back with my sheaves, you know, stalks of wheat with lots of kernels on there. I'm going to come back rejoicing. It works in evangelism. It works in mentoring. So Ricardo is a transvestite prostitute in New York. He hears about Jim Cymbala's church in Brooklyn, and he says, you know what, my life is, I have AIDS, I have a terrible life, I wonder if Jesus can make me happy. So he visits Jim Cymbala's church, and he has a good experience, and he goes back the next week and the next week, and pretty soon he becomes a Christian. Well, then the congregation at Brooklyn Tabernacle rallies around him, and they have to teach him everything. They say, you know, Ricardo, it would be nice if you cut your hair so you didn't look like you had a girl's hairstyle anymore. So he cut his hair. And they said, and on the other hand, you know, these clothes that you're wearing, you could wear a little bit better, you know, male clothing. And so he did. And then, Ricardo, you know, the way you sit like that and bob your leg, it looks like a girl. Do you think you could cross your legs this way instead of that way? And so they taught him how to cross his legs. Finally, he was able to get into a rehab center because he was a drug addict as well. And in all of this mentoring, he became a for real servant of God. He ended up marrying a Christian girl, and AIDS eventually took his life. But before he died, the church recorded on video his testimony. That testimony went viral, and it was on Billboard's bestseller list for months. You know, what a great ending to life. So it works for evangelism. You bring precious seed, you know. Here's the gospel, here's the gospel, here's the gospel. It works for mentoring. Oh, you know, you could do it this way. The Bible says this, and God says this, and you could do it this way. And you mentor people along. Next thing you know, you have a for real harvest. Isn't that something? And it works for our own spirituality. One of my favorite examples of this is Anne Voskamp. Most of you have run into her writings and that sort of thing. It's so interesting because she was in such a desperate strait. Even though she was saved as a child, she just struggled. They had tragedy. Her little sister was run over by a car. It broke everybody's hearts. Everybody was upset with God about it. And so all of her life, she's struggling with this traumatic experience, and then affected how her parents related to the kids and everything. And so she's always anxious and always depressed. Next thing you know, she is on psychiatric medication for her depression and anxiety, but even that doesn't help very much. So she's cutting herself. She's thinking about suicide. She has stomach ulcers from anxiety. She's all upset all the time. But she's trying to follow the Lord, right? She's doing a good job as best as she can. At 20 years old in 1994, she gets married to a farmer who has 600 acres, and that's kind of cool. You can be a farmer's wife. Pretty soon, they have six children, and so she's a farmer's wife, mother of six, homeschooling them, going to church and active in her church. In 2004, she started a blog about just life and faith. And she was saying that it seems so hard sometimes to find any joy in the duties of the farm and the kids and the rush. And there's just no joy. And besides, she just knows she's going to make one false move and one of the kids is going to end up dead. And it scares her to death. And there's just no joy. And her friend said, "You know, Anne, you have like this list of grievances against God, against the universe. I think it's messing up your life. It's eclipsing your joy. Why don't you try to make a list of 1,000 things that you think are grand, 1,000 things that you can be thankful for?" And that started it. The book eventually came out called 1,000 Gifts. And so she started actually keeping a list, like, you know, a little journal, and she kept it on the near the kitchen sink. And every time she thought of something that she was really thankful for, she'd write it down. Next thing you know, her list of grievances has been totally eclipsed by her journal of gratitude. And she doesn't feel like the world is bad anymore. Now she feels like the world is good. And she says, 1,000 Gifts is my story of my fight for joy and thanksgiving in the midst of everyday challenges and some deeper, darker parts of my past. This is me working that process out. I would never experience the fullness of my salvation until I express the fullness of my thanks every day. And she literally cured herself by thanking God. With all of the hardships that were really so desperate, she's well now. She's okay. Why? Because if you go forth bearing precious seed, little verses from God about gratitude, rejoicing in the Lord, thinking on the things that are true and lovely, bearing precious seed, next thing you know, you have a harvest. And so you just keep planting it day after day and waiting and planting and cultivating. And next thing you know, you have a new life. And that's how the rejoicing works. So from the 126th Psalm, let me tell you that God will make all your dreams come true eventually if you just follow Him. And besides the biggest dreams, He has all these little ones that He's also going to add to it. You see, it's true if you follow Him. And remember that you are co-laborers. We are laborers together with God in this. So you go and you sow that seed, that precious seed, those little truths of Scripture. Let them keep planting in your heart over and over and over and over. And you watch. You're going to have a great harvest. That's what we learned from the 126th Psalm.